and welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Features Podcast. Today we have a fabulous director who's moved halfway across the country during a pandemic, so I'm sure the good story's got to be in there somewhere. With his new film, The Honeymoon Phase, is we have director, actor, producer, caterer maybe, we'll get into it. Philip Carroll is here and he's wearing a Honeymoon Phase t-shirt. Can people buy them? Maybe we should start right there. Can anybody buy a shirt off you?
So these were actually given to us from our executive producer. Everybody that worked on the film got a cast and crew shirt. So this is an exclusive just for the people that worked on it. But we will be making some merch after the release of the film. Yes.
So there you go. See, everybody, so please buy a shirt off this man. He had to move. He had to feed himself. Lots of money. So let's start at the beginning of your film. You come on the screen. You're like, yeah, I gotta tell the viewer something that happened. It's kind of important. And boom, you like drop a bomb right at the beginning of your film. How is that as a writer to do that to us?
So I'll clarify that I'm not the one that plays Tom in the movie. A different actor plays him, but the character is based off of me. So there are a lot of similarities, I guess, between me and Tom. You know, Tom's a... No, let me backtrack. One of my favorite movies is American Beauty. And I love how at the very beginning of that, Lester's character says that in less than a couple months, he'll be dead, something like that. Because it just grabs your attention right away where you're like, oh my gosh, like they just kind of revealed the ending. But then you're wondering, well, what happens in the middle? Like, how do we get to that point? Because, you know, the beginning of the film... you know, in our movie, Tom and Eve are so much in love, you know, why would Eve, you know, kill herself in the end? Your attention to, you know, want to figure out, well, what drives this woman to the point that she would want to end her life? Because she seems like she's so happy with her lover.
Yeah, well, I know you're not the main character, but you're here to talk about it. So I'm going to put you on the stand. We know that. So, I mean... Did you ever have to go to marriage counseling or be a marriage counselor? Like, these are some heavy questions at the start of this film when they actually go to and get into the marriage in the honeymoon phase, when they enroll in the program.
Marriage counselor. I didn't need a counselor before making the movie. Now you'll have to ask Chloe. I don't know.
So you didn't like ask people for questions. These just all came to you? Because this just seems like a real happy couple when they start the whole process.
Yeah. So we, you know, being a young married person myself, I really wanted to explore what it was like while I was in my own honeymoon phase. And then, you know, in terms of coming out with the concept for the and I, or what a greatest fear would be for us. And for us, it's that idea of not knowing who your spouse is. So though we do have a happy marriage, the film was kind of an exploration of, well, what would it take to tear our marriage apart? And that idea of, you know, facade and not knowing who your partner is.
Very interesting. See, I haven't just ruined one thing about your film yet, have I? Totally good.
You're doing a good job. There's a lot of twists and turns on our movie, and I think between the two of us, we're doing a good job of alluding to things without revealing anything.
Okay, let's get some fun things right here. How long did it take the male lead actor to grow a beard?
It was probably about a month and a half. So when we cast Jim, I told him, you know, okay, so the opening of the film, you have a beard, and we're going to shoot all that on the first day, and then after that, you'll cut it. And for Jim, you know, he doesn't normally wear a beard, so it was a little painful for him. It was over the holidays, so all Christmas he said he was just scratching his face. All his family wondered if he was letting himself go. It was not only that, poor Jim. It was so funny, you know, being a writer myself, and I guess I'm going from my own experiences. I was like, Jim, you know, you're a really fit guy. Like, Jim works out nonstop, fitness enthusiast. And when we cast him, I was like, Jim, do you mind, you know, not working out between now and when the film comes out? Because as a struggling writer, I don't think he would have time to work out, you know, as Tom. You know, I don't think Tom is a fitness enthusiast. So can you get a little bit of the dad bod going? And probably channeling a little bit of myself here as a reference point. But poor Jim, you know, he struggled over that month to not work out. I think he said he would go for runs, but other than that, he wasn't lifting weights. He wasn't doing anything like that. So he really did do the body transformation for the movie.
Let's be honest. If you ever need me for anything and you tell me I can't come to the gym for a month, it's not happening. Wow, I can't believe that Jim would go this length to be. I get what you're saying. I agree. Jim doesn't look like he goes to the gym.
Yes.
I totally agree with you there. But, I mean, that would kill me.
Oh, it killed him. I mean, he was doing, like, some push-ups where he could, and then I'd catch him. I'd be like, Jim, no, you're not allowed to do that. And he actually has a fitness blog, and he put on there kind of the experience of, you know, I don't want to say getting out of shape, but how to be healthy but not, you know, work out. Toning?
Well, we got to give – sorry, our internet's not doing well tonight. Are you there? Uh-oh. Hold on. Okay, so you let him go a whole month without working out. So you got to give this man full dedication to your film.
Oh, Jim was 100% dedicated to the movie. It was probably his worst nightmare to not be able to go to the gym and work out. He actually did a whole blog post on his fitness website talking about how to be healthy but get out of shape at the same time. And it was just a very fascinating thing. You know, he really Christian Bale'd it on this film.
Well, good for him. The headsets. You do have your characters wear headsets at a time. What really are the headsets, other than opposed to being headsets? Because I don't think they are.
So, great question. With the headsets, believe it or not, they are a meditation device that we bought on eBay and then augmented for the film. So they are, you can actually get pretty much a close replica of what we had in the movie. I forget what it's called, but if you search like meditation headset, something similar should pop up for you.
Well, that brings me to something. The outfits that your characters wear, really thought they were meditation outfits for some cult. Like, I really thought you sent them when the film starts and they get these outfits. I'm like, they're going to a cult, aren't they? Because I really thought it was a cult. And I don't think, I'm not really anything people, cults got nothing to do with this film at all. This is just my projection of what I'm thinking. Now, did you think the viewer would think that with those outfits, or just like, nope, it's going to be futuristic, they need a futuristic-looking outfit?
We thought that, you know, most people would take it, hopefully, as kind of these futuristic Black Mirror-ish uniforms. In the story of the movie, since they are having an experiment that is, you know, trying to figure out why couples fall out of the honeymoon phase, we thought that they should wear uniforms in order to remove any kind of variables that could potentially screw up with their results. So that's why they're both kind of wearing the same exact thing, the white top with the black pants, the barcode on there so they could be scanned in. And, you know, in terms of kind of metaphors with movie, I think that, you know, for married couples, a lot of times over the years, they kind of blend into one person in a way. It's kind of something that everybody jokes about, but people kind of start looking like each other. They start acting like each other. So the uniform is kind of a representation of that, too.
Well, I've been married 15 years, and I don't think me and my wife dress alike yet, so I hope it continues on that path. Okay. Let's move on.
Give it a few more years.
Give it some more years. You do have slight nudity in the film, and I believe it's your wife?
I can imagine where this question's going, but yes, it is my wife.
I'm not going to go any further than that. How did that feel, saying, okay, honey, I need you to do X?
Chloe is in the same way that Jim was dedicated with losing the fitness, Chloe was absolutely 100% dedicated to the role in all facets. And I mean, when she knew that there would be, you know, some romantic scenes in the movie, she herself also got into shape for the role. And, you know, to make yourself vulnerable like that, I'm so appreciative that she was willing to do that for the film. And, you know, as a husband and wife, you have to have 100% trust going into this. And I think, believe it or not, being the director actually helped make her feel more comfortable because – I was there right by her side through all of it, where, you know, if this was her first time doing it on a stranger set, I think it would have been a lot more difficult. We've done short films over the years together, so we've kind of learned how to compartmentalize our relationship, where when we're at home, you know, we're married and very much in love, and it's our personal life. But when we're on set, it's work and it's a job, and, you know, we're very respectful of that. So, you know, I think it was more of a challenge for our families to get over than it was for us, where it was never weird for us to have to work together in that capacity.
So when you were writing this, did you always have your wife in mind and Jim in mind, or did you have other actors in your head?
So I always had Chloe in mind, because when we set out to do this movie, we wanted it to be our feature debut for me as a director and Chloe as an actress. So we're hoping it's something that can, you know, jumpstart our careers. Now just moving to Los Angeles and the film coming out, that was always kind of the goal with the project. Now for Jim, we actually did an open casting call for the role of Tom. But I actually knew Jim from a commercial that I shot the year prior. And we had a wedding scene that we shot, and Jim was the groom in the commercial. So I already knew what he looked like in a tux. And actually, the tux that he wears in the film is the same one that he wore in the commercial. So, you know, low-budget indie filmmaking, you got to find places to cut. So we reused the same tux. It fit him like a glove, so it was perfect.
Uh-oh, you stopped again. Okay, you're good to go again.
Okay. So, So for the audition process with Jim, he did a self-tape, and we brought him in along with a couple other actors that we liked and individually ran a couple key scenes from the movie. And Jim just came in so prepared, ready to go, asked all the right questions about the character. And the thing that really impressed me about him was after, you know, we were done with his takes of the scenes, he asked if he could go one more time. And Jim went up to Chloe and asked her if he could hold her hand for a moment. And Chloe was like, yeah, sure. So they held hands, and it just formed this instant connection between them where it allowed Jim to kind of feel what the stakes were. Like, this is the person that he's fighting for. And he re-ran the scene, and it was like a revelation. Like, Jim was Tom. It was really incredible. And, you know, from that point forward, Jim really gave 110%. This was his first feature as well. So, you know, everybody had something to prove.
So don't take this wrong, but they do seem like a couple to me. Like, I do feel there was a connection between the two. Obviously, I know they're actors. They do their thing. But I really, if you told me they were married in real life, I'd be like, yep, okay, I'll let it go. Sounds good to me.
That's the ultimate compliment for them as actors. I mean, they really, we had five different rehearsal days where the two of them and me built that relationship together. It was almost like a weird polygamous relationship during the rehearsals and everything, where I was kind of their coaching them through, you know, being in love. And, you know, it was, you know, on set they were Tom and Eve. And then as soon as they went home, Jim went to his wife, Chloe came back with me, and that was that. But in the relationship that they built in the film, you know, it was really incredible. And when we were casting the film, something that I was really adamant about was I wanted the actor who played Tom to be married, because I wanted there to be an authenticity to how they reacted to things in terms of the relationship, because it's different when you're married. You know, when you're young and in love and dating, you know, that's one kind of stage in the relationship. But then when you get married, it's kind of a deeper kind of love. And I really wanted the actor who played Tom to know that the same way that Chloe did, so they could, you know, hopefully recreate a version of that on screen.
Wow, that was an awesome answer. I don't even ask more questions. I should just give you little nudges and let you go. CGI effects play a tremendous role in your film. I think they, a little bit of Star Wars influence, but I mean, I'm just sort of see a little new hope with the R2 Princess Leia scene there a few times, but that's fine. I don't think you're ripping it off. I think you're paying homage. Am I wrong there? Is that what your plan was, or I'm just reading into it?
No, so that was definitely one of the inspirations for it. Our VFX supervisor, David DeLeon, his visual reference was actually Star Trek. But he did some of the visual effects on, I think, it was Star Trek Discovery. Oh, wow. And he kind of based some of his designs off of that. So we were both coming at it from a similar angle. I think the R2 ones are a little bit more blue, where I wanted a little bit more skin tones in ours. But, yeah, a hologram's a hologram.
So how was it? This is your first feature, and you're doing CGI, which I don't mean to be rude. I do not see an indie film too often, like very rarely. So did you always have plans for CGI? I mean, that's a big cost factor for you, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
It was always written into the script. We kind of went back and forth with the hologram specifically. In some early drafts of the script, it was a screen that they would interact with, you know, more like a TV. But it just it didn't feel, you know, sci-fi enough for the world that we were trying to build. You know, we wanted it so that it was almost like a person was coming into your house as opposed to you interacting with somebody outside. You know, we wrote it with the visual effects in mind. I think when you're making your first film, there's a little element of being naive that's important, where, you know, you don't really quite know what you're getting yourself into. And by doing that, sometimes you come up with some really great stuff, because if you had that kind of fear blocking you, you would stop yourself before you even tried. It was pretty crazy to do the amount of visual effects that we had in the film. I think there were over 300 that we had.
Oh, wow.
Between holograms, the labs later in the film without going into too much, and, you know, the butterflies, things like that. The damn butterflies, man. I wish we would have rented butterflies, you know, from a breeder. Rob Cacagna, who did the VFX butterflies, he's so proud of them, because it's really hard to get butterflies right. I've seen a lot of movies with fake butterflies, and you're like, ah, that looks fake. But I think he did actually a really good job with them.
No, I think everything in your film looks great. CGI effects, I'm impressed. That's why I'm giving you full props to the CGI guy.
Hey, all that goes to our team. You know, they really worked nonstop to make those VFX, you know, look okay. Realistic.
I do want to ask about the head of the program. I'll try to be as vague as I can.
Okay.
Any homage to Godzilla, or is just that's the look of the guy you wanted?
So Francois Chau, who plays the role of the director in the film, his character is more of an homage to the head of the Dharma Initiative in Lost that he actually played when he was on that TV show. So the look, you know, we wanted somebody that was, you know, on the outside had the lab coat, and then on the inside, you know, you have the black turtleneck, kind of hinting to maybe, you know, some nefarious motives in there. But yeah, he was an absolute dream to work with.
I apologize. I've only seen one season of Lost and a bit of season two. So that's why I had no idea who he was. I said, oh, he's got the look. I like him. So
he actually, you might know him from, I never watched these films, but everybody on set was like blown away when they found out. But he plays Shredder in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Secret of the Ooze from the 90s.
That's him?
That's him.
I totally know who he is. Yes, I would have been blown away too. That would have made my day. Okay, indie film location is like the hardest thing for you to get. If you need something, it's hard to get. And you have tons of them. Now, I do have to – you have one office location, which is at the beginning when they walk in. I don't think I'm ruining anything. Whose office? How did you get it?
So – there's a story behind the office. So the office, we got, let me take a step back. The Philadelphia film office that we worked with on the project were absolutely incredible. They have a locations website where you can go on, put in what you're looking for, and then their database will spit out results that kind of fit that description. And then they'll put you in contact with the location owners. So we knew we wanted this high-tech office space for the Millennium Project at the beginning of the film. So they put us in touch with this law firm that had an office space, and the partner at the firm that we talked to was super excited to have a film there because he had just recently renovated the place and wanted to have it on film. So it was almost like a match made in heaven. He was like, yeah, do what you want. We have people that can rearrange furniture. You know, you just tell us what you need, and, you know, all we want is to have our office on film. So it was a completely free location.
No, I'm not going to let you go that way that easily. You know what the next thing I'm going to do is a house location.
Yes.
I don't think it's a house. Like, that view is amazing.
is. That house, it was so hard to find the house. We searched for months to find the right house because in the script I wanted something that was futuristic looking but also a little unnerving, you know, kind of like a modernist house, but, you know, having some sci-fi elements in there. And for the house, we actually found it through Airbnb. And we reached out to the people that were renting it, and they were a couple themselves, a lawyer team, which was kind of cool, these two attorneys. And the wife was from the UK, and Chloe's from the UK. So we kind of bonded over this, you know, we're both creative partners, and the wife is from the UK, and, you know, we hit it off. And they were able to work out a deal with us to where we were able to rent their house for a month. And because it was a rental property for them, they were totally cool with us repainting the house. So all the different rooms had different color walls, and they let us repaint most of them clinical white, which was amazing. So we wow. hired a painter, repainted their house. You know, their only stipulation was that it was off-white. So we had to find the closest white to off-white for them. And we sent them the little paint card, and they're like, yeah, that's fine. So it worked
wow.
out.
Wow, you repainted a whole house. That's insane. Okay, I do want to go to the very end of the film. It's a long corridor. It's got a lot of stuff going on.
Yes.
Let's go over that location.
Okay, so for that location, there was actually a hospital outside of Philadelphia in Chester County, I believe. And the hospital campus had a wing that was not being used anymore. And they had all of the hospital equipment in there for that wing that was just in storage. So they said that, you know, pretty much any equipment that was on that floor we could use and believe it or not, also repaint because we wanted it white. So our production designer, Dave Zhao, he repainted all of that stuff. And we had free reign to this abandoned wing of the hospital. Creed actually shot a few of the scenes where Rocky is getting chemotherapy there. So we chose a few spots, and they were also great to work with. The thing that is really wonderful about shooting in Philadelphia is everybody's excited when you say you're making a movie because they're not used to it. So you just say you're making a movie, and everybody wants to be a part of it. The community comes together because, you know, they want to show their city in the best light. So it was really cool.
So I'm going to continue on. Your plot, is your plan for your plot always to build, and boom at the end?
Yes. So we kind of based it off of, it's an older style, I think, of storytelling nowadays, you know, compared to nowadays, where it's very much like the old 70s, 80s horror, where it's like a slow burn, you know, like The Shining, Rosemary's Baby. You know, it takes its time, like, laying the seeds to things. And I always wanted it to, like you said, have kind of that explosive third act where, like, when it goes, it's firing all cylinders and, you know, it's nonstop then until pretty much the end.
Okay. Well, we got to go over the music. I yes. cannot let that go. You have the most calming relaxation music I've heard in a long time. I'm just like sitting there going, I'm being set up for something and I know I am. But this music is just so relaxing.
So our composer, Chris Ryan, he was absolutely incredible to work with. That was one of my favorite parts of the process. It's when we got to the soundtrack. You know, we came up with these themes for each of the characters in the movie and the locations. And like you said, you know, we kind of looked at it, you know, when we were talking shorthand, the Millennium Project, we wanted it to feel like Epcot. Where, like, when you go there, you know, it's Disney World. It's uplifting. It's like, this is the future but perfected. And then over the course of the film, we slowly start to turn that. You know, these themes that you hear in the beginning of the movie that are very positive and forward-thinking then begin to kind of show a dark side to them. And one of the fun things, actually, too, with the music that we did was the music, without spoiling it too much, the music kind of tells you the story of the film. You know, if you're listening to the themes in it, you can kind of figure out what's going on at different points. You know, when you rewatch the movie, hopefully you'll be able to kind of see musically the story kind of revealing itself to you up front.
Oh, I love the pop song. I think that should be a single.
Another fun Easter egg with that. The woman that runs up to the front door of the house in the movie, and she's banging on the door saying, yes, let me in. She is one of the singers of that song.
Okay, we can go into that. It's one scene I want to discuss. I'm going to go over very slightly. I wanted more of that to know what was going on, and I love how you got rid of it. I think you explained that away so easily. And at the time, you're thinking, that doesn't make much sense, but by the end, it does. Like, yes. You had me at the time going, okay, what? And then you just sort of leave me there and never go back to it. Then you explain it away. I'm like, okay, sure, I'll let it go. It makes sense. So did you have it in there as a red herring or just there to – because you kind of push us off to that side at that point.
Yes.
And then go the other way later.
Yeah, so we wanted to have some red herrings in there in order to, you know, have the twist be more impactful. And that was definitely one of them. Now, if you know the ending to the film, you know, that's what happened in that scene, I think, makes a little bit more sense.
Absolutely, it does. But at the time, yes. And you're like, what the?
Yeah, what is going on here? And it was a point in the movie, too, like when I was writing the script, I tell people that I kind of view structurally screenplays as almost like one of those Hot Wheel tracks that you play with as a kid where,
so
you know, you need these booster moments where like the car goes through and it pushes it through to the next hill. And for me, that was one of those motors where it was like, okay, we're getting to a point where it could be, you know, a slowdown moment in the movie where we're like, okay, you know, they're in love. I get it. We need something to happen here. And that was, you know, that engine moment where it kicks off the next part of the movie where it's like, okay, now Eve is going down a path of paranoia. That was kind of the first inciting incident to that.
Okay, some weird questions for you. How many condoms were used? Are there any issues with the condoms?
I wish I knew the amount. It was definitely a box. And I believe it was Trojan was the brand. We were joking about making the film an ad for them. But you know, it's actually probably the opposite. It's probably more of an ad for, you know, birth controls for women than condoms. Going into a little bit more detail, the contents inside the condoms were hand lotion.
I figured as much. I was probably hoping. You knew it was coming. Now, next question is: Never Have I Ever the worst game ever.
I feel like Never Have I Ever is a game that all couples have to play at some point in the relationship, and probably drunk.
True.
For me and Chloe, we've definitely played it, and thankfully we're very honest up front, so there were no bad revelations on that front. So we have fun with it. For some relationships, it probably could be the end.
I've never played it with my wife and hope she never hears this interview to make me play that game because I don't think I want to.
you would not survive.
Probably not. Working with blood. How was that as an experience?
Working with what? I'm sorry?
Blood.
Oh, working with blood. Okay, so some people love working with blood. I wouldn't say I hate it, but on an indie film level, it's a pain in the butt because, you know, you have a small crew, you got to leave your locations better off than you found them. So it's time consuming, you know, to clean up the blood, to reset things. Luckily on our film, we had a really good team. Doug Sackman, who did the practical effects, he handled all of the blood and, you know, he did a great job. He had an assistant on a few of the days and, we had some practical squibs, which were really fun to work with. And there's a scene, I don't want to reveal too much, but there's a scene where somebody gets shot with us and there's a squib. And the way that the blood falls down the shirt was like beyond perfect. It was just the coolest thing in the world. And it was a very happy accident. So I'll say the blood was good to us. So I won't talk trash on it too much. It's just as a filmmaker, it's a tough thing to work with.
Okay. The break of the wall. You have a breaking of a wall at one point. Yep. How is doing that? That's something else you don't see in indie film often.
Yeah, so when I wrote that into the script, that was one of those things where I was like, how the heck are we going to pull this off? So I challenged Dave, our production designer, to come up with a solution listen to it. And he basically built a fake wall where the closet would be in the bedroom. So he removed the closet doors, got some drywall, put it up, and then since we were repainting the rooms anyway, we just painted it all to match. And then on the day, Chloe just went to town on the wall. And funny story with that, everybody on the crew was like, you know, Chloe, just do your best. You know, it's drywall. It's probably going to be hard to rip through. And she got pissed and she saw it as a challenge and got fired up. And she's like, don't tell me, you know, I'm some, you know, weak little girl. Like, I'm going to go for it. And she pulled at that wall so hard that she pulled the entire piece of drywall down. And thank God somebody was standing in front of the camera and caught it right before it hit the camera. But she pulled the whole thing down, and thank God we got the tape, you know, when we did, because we couldn't reset it. The wall was gone at that point. But she's stronger than she looks.
Okay, it's time for your favorite part that you've prepped for these whole 2 days of interviews for your film. It's fun questions. Because it's your first time on the show, your favorite film, please?
My favorite film is Forrest Gump.
Your favorite meal on set?
Oh, God. Probably Wendy's. I like when people, like, half the time on set, I would, you know, as a way to clear my head, I drive to the nearest Wendy's, get takeout, eat, clear my head, and then come back.
Fair enough. And your last question, what could you tell new indie film directors what they should know?
You know, I'm going to go along with kind of what I was saying earlier, where I will actually say nothing to that question. I think it's better not going in knowing too much. You know, when you're making your first movie, go in just with kind of naive excitement. You know, you'll figure it out. If it's something that you're really passionate about, you'll find a way to make it happen if you surround yourself with the right people. It's filmmaking's hard enough as it is, you know, with the budgets and things like that. I think sometimes you can get bogged down in the details and everything. So kind of keep that naive childlike wonder and excitement for making movies, and then go in and formulate a plan and just do it.
Now, your film, The Honeymoon Phase, is available where?
So The Honeymoon Phase comes out in the U.S. on Friday, the 21st of August, and it will be available on Apple TV, which is iTunes. They recently kind of rechanged the branding to Apple TV. Amazon Prime Video, Google Play, Vimeo On Demand, and then some of the major on-demand services. You know, like Comcast and those. The Comcast one might be coming a few days later. The version that I would recommend personally as a filmmaker would be the Apple TV iTunes one if you can, because we have these really cool iTunes extras that will unlock on September 29th. So there will be a complete making of, deleted scenes, bloopers, an alternate ending. It's pretty much like the filmmaker's dream package. So if you're going to get a version, I would recommend buying the Apple TV one. And then, like I said, the iTunes extras will automatically unlock at the end of September.
Well, thank you so much for your time. You're very informative. Have a great evening.
Hey, thank you very much, Simon. It was an honor chatting with you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.